We always have so many things to tell our audience about here at Intelligence Squared. So when I'm needing a top-down view of it all, I don't want to feel like I'm looking at organized chaos. That's why I really love Notion, which lays out different threads of work in a beautifully designed layout. And despite all of its clever AI tech going on in the background, it feels as clear and easy as putting pen to paper. Remember that? But with Notion, you can do a lot more than jot down a few thoughts. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. And thanks to its AI-powered model, the way it works is so intuitive, every question has an answer. I still love my paper notebook, but sitting next to Notion, it might need to up its game a little bit. Try Notion for free and up your game too when you go to notion.com/squared. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting Intelligence Squared too. That's notion.com/squared.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to Intelligence Squared. Today we're hearing from David Spiegelhalter, the statistician, academic, and newspaper columnist based at Cambridge University, whose grasp of big numbers earned him a knighthood for his services to statistics in 2014. Virologist and host of the Naked Scientist podcast, Dr. Chris Smith, speaks to David on the show today about his new book, Analyzing the COVID-19 Pandemic. Here's Chris with more.
COVID has, of course, reshaped the world and all of our lives. Each day, fresh studies and new numbers come along that give us new perspective on the virus. Making sense of that constantly shifting mountain of data, though, can be a big challenge. So who better than David Spiegelhalter, the renowned statistician and expert on risk and uncertainty, to tell us what those figures really mean? David's new book, COVID by Numbers, written with Anthony Masters, seeks to do just that. It's also pertinent that, actually, as we welcome David to the programme, it marks the publication of a report that scrutinises how the UK government has handled the COVID pandemic crisis, and also the rise to prominence of the now famous phrase, "We are following the science." So, David, have we followed the science?
I hope not. No, I don't like that phrase at all. You know, it was used a lot at the beginning of the lockdown, you know, and this report, you know, that came out today from the Select Committee sort of suggests that at the beginning there was a kind of unity between what the politicians and the scientists were saying. But, you know, science doesn't tell us what to do. It never can. And so this following the science seems like an attempt to shift responsibility onto the scientists. And they should, I think, refuse to take that on.
I mean, that was the case. Many scientists did begin to object because they said this is coming across as political arse covering. And we do not want to be associated with policy. Science isn't policy.
Well, I completely agree. You could say that to quite a few scientists who have continued to say what we should be doing. Now, at the time, you know, there were scientists arguing against the government, you know, and what was being, they were going on the media, they were on social media saying we should be acting earlier and so on. And they turned out to be, well, looks like it, right. I wasn't one of them at all. You know, I think I misjudged the whole thing. But, and so I'm glad I wasn't recommending policy, because actually, it's not my job, and it's not, really, it's not a job of any single scientist working in a single area, even public health people.
But that's a very bold admission you just made, that you said I misjudged it. I mean, if you can misjudge it, anyone can misjudge it. In what way did you get it wrong then?
My personality makes me, you know, completely unable or, you know, inappropriate that I should advise people what to do. I'm a chronic optimist. I underestimate what might go wrong. I assume everything's going to be okay. And so I know that about myself. And so I keep my gob shut when it comes to things like this, because I actually wrote down what I thought might be the impact of the virus. And as my own little private bet, I put probabilities on the total number of deaths during the year. I can't remember exactly, but I thought, you know, there was a low probability it'd be more than 20,000 or even 15,000 or something like that. So I was hopelessly wrong. And so I'm glad I shut up. But, you know, in a way, there is this issue of how much scientists should be advising. And I think everyone should listen to science when they're making any policy. I think science is incredibly important. To ignore it is absolutely nonsensical. But in the end, the scientists are not those responsible for these decisions. You know, any decision made about policy is a political decision that takes into account much wider perspectives than just the scientific viewpoint. You know, I studied decision theory, and as soon as you get into decision theory, you know that, you know, one part of it, of course, is probabilities and what possibilities, what might happen, and so on. But then the other part of it is, what is the value of these consequences in the absolute broader sense? And I don't think scientists, that's not what we do. So I really believe in science. I believe in it being very important. But and I could say, what I do believe that science should do is to look at the possibilities in a very imaginative way of what the options are. It should look at the possible consequences in a way, but those are always limited essentially to things we can measure or try to measure. And then it should give an idea of what might happen if we do certain things, the winners and losers, the benefits and harms. And that's, of course, covered with enormous uncertainty. And then, in the end, they have to present that to the people who have to make the decisions, with warnings about the worst things that could happen and so on. And so I made this analogy that instead of following the science isn't out there in front saying, come on, this way, and telling us what to do, it's sort of walking beside the decision makers, sort of muttering to itself, probably bickering amongst itself, and suggesting what might happen if you go in various directions.
That's the whole issue of modelling, isn't it? Because that has been the thing that has dominated this pandemic, apart from the fact that we've injected into the national vocabulary all kinds of jargon and buzzwords like R-value and herd immunity. The word model has probably featured up there more than almost any other when considering what we should do and what might happen in the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a modeler at all. And I think they can be valuable. I think that, like I think some people have suggested, they could possibly have played far too big a role in the whole discourse. Everyone's obsessed about them. But in fact, I'm not convinced, given the enormous uncertainties and how, the models come up with a huge range of possibilities, because they're dependent on, first of all, what we don't know about the virus, and crucially, they're dependent on what we don't know about how people will behave. And so the uncertainties are so huge that they really just given a feeling of how things could be really awful or they might not be that bad. And that's almost it.
So why has the government taken them so seriously?
I'm not sure if they, the extent to which they have. They have been very useful. The stuff that comes out of SPIEM is great. It shows the sort of range of possibilities and some sort of central values, but they've got things wrong. All the teams have, or at least most of the stuff that's come out at various times. Chris Whitty has sort of said that, he actually much prefers looking at what's happening and what, the short-term consequences might be. And when something like in last March is doubling away every few days, you don't have to have a very complex model. In fact, we don't know what's going to happen. We do know it's going to get really bad and something should be done. So I don't want to get in a big argument between statisticians and modellers, whatever, but I think modellers can be useful, but I'm not sure. I mean, the parliamentary report does say that they think that too much notice was taken of models. And I suppose I got a bit of sympathy with that.
The thing I was quite surprised by was to see things like R values being described in the figures that are given out to the public, and the fact that they actually started using this sort of maths and stats and modelling speak. And the thing I really liked about the new book you've just published is the fact you take everybody through each of these sections and you explain what a lot of this thing that will now be quite familiar parlance to people, what it is, what it does, what it means and where it comes from. But let's touch on R for a minute, because that surfaced pretty quickly, didn't it? Right at the beginning of all of this, we started to hear about the R value for this. So to orientate people, what actually is R? And how does R for COVID compare with R for, say, flu?
Yeah. No, I think R has been incredibly valuable as a single summary, you know, one number that people could grab hold of and which does, you know, roughly reflect what's going on in the community. So I think it has been very valuable. It's a gross simplification. I mean, it's a sort of average over a whole group of people about how many people anyone who's got an infection would be expected to infect. And so the basic reproduction number, what's called R0, is if a virus hits a completely virgin population in which nobody's really taking any precautions, how many people it's expected to infect. And for estimates they got there. There's some really excellent work done by the, for example, the Imperial Group and others in estimating R very early on from the data that was available, and also estimating the infection fatality rate, which is again very, very nice work that that appeared in their March the 16th report. R sort of roughly 3 for the virus, the sort of COVID, SARS-CoV-2 version 1. And that's considerably more than flu, which, oh, come on, Chris, you must be. Is flu what, about 1.6 or something like that?
The numbers I've seen are about 1.3.
Yeah, so flu isn't very much at all. You know, every person is likely to affect one and maybe two people on average. It's not big at all. But as soon as people start taking precautions, or a lot of people start getting immunity, then R drops. And it's a nice summary because it gives a sort of tilt and balance. You say a balancing point. If R is less than one, it means that the epidemic is essentially shrinking. If it's greater than one, it's increasing. And so, it is a bigger... It's an average in so many ways, because it's an average over whole areas of the country, although they have tried to estimate it in more specific areas. But it's also an average in terms of the number of people that someone infects. But it's an average of what is actually a hugely skewed distribution. I mean, right from the early on, it was concluded that most people didn't infect anybody at all. 80% of infections are provoked or transmitted by only 10% of the population.
I was surprised when I actually saw that statistic, because that was data from India as well, wasn't it? There was a very powerful paper from India published in a top journal where they actually showed this very dramatic spread originating from a tiny number of people. Why do we think that happens then?
You're the virologist. You can tell me. I don't know. No, it just means that. And this is why I got multiple examples of where quoting an average can, in fact, give a very wrong impression. When you've got a hugely skewed distribution, where actually the most likely value is 0, but then there's reasonable chance of infecting quite a lot of people. And, of course, then we get up to these super spreader events and choirs and things like that, when somebody might infect 50 people. So, those are also very rare, I think. But the point is that very few people actually infect 3 people with this virus. It's either more or substantially less. And so that can be a bit misleading, but it's a useful figure. But the other thing about R is we can't just go and see it. We can't measure it. If we're looking at the number of people infected in serious, in principle, we can do surveys and we can actually find that out. We can't go out and measure R. It's very much a virtual quantity that we can only infer from looking at how many people are getting infected and sort of working backwards from a model that we've got.
Of course, the other thing that became subsequently toxic, unfortunately, during the coverage of the pandemic was this phrase herd immunity, which is a very sound epidemiological and vaccine related piece of terminology, isn't it? But R can tell us something about that, can't it? Because it can tell us roughly what proportion of the population we need to get immune in order for the thing to stop spreading.
Yeah, again, it's really the really sort of simple stuff that if virus is going to, on average, infect 3 people, if in a virgin population, and if actually 2 out of those 3 people were actually immune, then we'd only infect 1 and the epidemic wouldn't grow. And so that means, if R is 3, you want 2/3 of the population to be immune. So what you're actually doing is 1 minus 1 over R naught. That's 1 minus 1/3 in that case. Would stop the epidemic growing. And that's great as a simple calculation, but it's not a description of what's going on, particularly because the huge variation in the actual number of people that someone infects, the R is only an average, but also, it requires people to be completely immune. And, if I could be vaxxed to the eyeballs, I'm not immune. We found that there's breakthrough infections a lot. Vaccination just doesn't stop you getting the virus again. And so I think herd immunity has got such a toxic phrase, but, the idea of a substantial pool of immunity in the population is, of course, incredibly important. That's why, at the moment, this country is hovering along at a sort of, fairly level, but high level of infections, because there's so much immunity in the population.
So are we, do you think, moving away from the idea that we can actually achieve herd immunity through vaccination because we just can't stop it because the vaccines are leaky and therefore we have to change our thinking?
Yeah, you could never get to herd immunity, I don't think. Basically, with the Delta variant, R's gone up to about 7. So if we use that simple calculation, it would require 6/7 of the population to be completely immune. And what's 6/7? What's that? About 86% or something like that. Yeah, but even if you're vaxxed to the absolute gunnels, you're not 86% immune against infection.
So where does that leave us then with interventions like Nicola Sturgeon, Mark Drakeford saying we're going to have vaccine passports to come to nightclubs? Because presumably then that's like saying we're putting this sticking plaster over the door, but it's a breathable sticking plaster. It's got holes in it.
No, everything's got holes in it. This is all to do with risk reduction. It's not to do with eliminating the risk completely of these things. In Italy, you can't buy a cup of coffee in a shop without having a double being double vaxxed. So, and it's not saying that's going to eliminate everything. I mean, I think people have got that now. The vaccines are not perfect. The tests are not perfect, and so on, and that. The whole issue of false positives, of breakthrough cases and things, that this has permeated, popular thinking and even political thinking, I think. They've finally got into people's heads so in a way this is enormous progress because, statisticians have been going on for ages about we've got to think about sensitive, how accurate tests are. They're not perfect at all. They can never be sure and so on. Always the residual uncertainty, having done something or got some result. We're always going on about the fact that, but there's still a chance that. And that now, I think, has really penetrated and certainly into the media and so on. And so, people, the level of discussion has definitely got more sophisticated.
There definitely seems to have been an acceptance, where previously, for a long time, the messaging coming from certain quarters was we should pursue a zero COVID strategy. We should aim for this to be zero, eliminate this from at least our geography. We should follow the example of Australia, follow the example of New Zealand. That seems to have switched. The feeling I get is that now people have accepted that actually we agree that that's probably not going to be possible based on what we've learned about the agent. And probably we have to pursue one of mitigation of the impact, but accept that this thing's here to stay at least for a while.
Yeah, I think everyone's accepted that now. Even the people who previously would be arguing for a zero COVID elimination strategy. Of course, that doesn't mean to say that, back in March last year, 2020, it might not have been better to try to do this. I'm not going to get into all of that, whether we should have tried to be like Australia and New Zealand, because that maybe not be feasible as a long-term strategy doesn't mean that the countries that tried to do that were wrong to even try it last year. There's a lot to do with, buying time, I think, especially when you think there might be a vaccine in the offing. I mean, we've yet to see. Now Australia and New Zealand have got to, and other countries got to deal with of shifting away from that strategy, which brings its own huge problems. So it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens there. But crucially, a lot of these things are buying time to set up services and for the vaccines to be developed. I mean, my understanding is that the scientists back last March, February and March, were arguing against border controls because they wouldn't stop it. Yeah, but that's not quite the point. I think nothing's going to would have stopped it, I don't think, completely at that point, and we certainly can't stop it now. But that doesn't mean that delaying it at the early stages would not have been a good thing because of just buying time to get the health services sorted, to work out what you're going to do, and you know, the, it just makes the vaccine that bit closer before it comes.
The other thing you devote quite a few column inches to in your writing, and I'm glad you did, because you make it very clear in the book, is about testing and how tests perform. Because this is very much something that's a black box for most people. You do a swab, you get a result. I believe it, black and white, simple. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's I think, also becoming very clear that not all tests are made equal, and mm-hmm. tests have different performances and different pickup rates. And that can be very hard, I think, people to understand in the first instance. You know, what is a false positive? What is a false negative? What's the gold standard here? What's the difference between the performance of a PCR test and a lateral flow test? And when should we use one? When should we use another?
Oh, and that's just the start. It gets far more difficult than that. That's the easy bit. The difficult bit is that, you know, how you interpret a test depends crucially on why you did the test and what's going on in the community in which you're testing people. I mean, this is just the most difficult and unintuitive area. It's disaster. Even the language is unintuitive and ambiguous. What does false positive rate mean? I can think of three definitions.
Well, I think sensitivity and specificity is very, very hard to get your head around, actually. Most people would say, do you know, I haven't got a clue.
But at least they could learn what it meant. Whereas if you ask people what is the false negative rate, it's an ambiguous term. It hasn't got a fixed definition. You know, false negative rate, is it? Okay, it's false negatives, but as a proportion of what? As a proportion of everybody who hasn't got the disease, or as a proportion of all the negative tests? It's not clear at all. So sensitivity and specificity, it's not jargon. These are terms that just make it clear what you're talking about. However, It sounds like jargon. It sounds, nobody knows what that means. So we're left with using terms like false positive and false negative rate, and yet trying to always define them so that people know what they are, because everyone gets them mixed up and nobody knows what they really mean, and the whole thing's a shambles. So, and, you know, it's not, many people have done their best to try to explain it. But as I said, the most difficult thing is the fact that you can have a test, you know, like lateral flows, you know, or any diagnostic test, when there's very little virus floating around, the problem is false positives. And when there's lots of virus floating around, the problem becomes false negatives. So that which is what we're seeing at the moment, because there's lots of virus at the moment. And so the issue is, one of the controversial issues at the moment is how often, you know, kids might do a lateral flow test and it comes out positive, and then they check it with the PCR. The PCR comes up negative, and they think, oh, well, that's okay then. Well, no, it's not okay, actually. A very large number, that does not mean you haven't got the virus at all. If you're in a situation where there's a lot of virus around and you get a positive lateral flow, it's very rare to get a false positive lateral flow. So,
well, it's about 1 in 1,000, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. So, you know, if you haven't got it, the chance of it being positive. And so if there's also a lot of virus circulating and you get a positive lateral flow, it's a very high chance you've actually got an infection. But PCRs, are not perfect at picking up infections. So there, it's quite possible you can have a false negative PCR because the swab may be done badly or whatever. And so actually, you can have a positive lateral flow and then a negative PCR, and there's still a reasonable chance that you have got the virus. It does not rule out you having the virus. Although, you know, people generally say, oh, the PCR is better than the lateral flow. Yeah, but not when used in this context. It doesn't reverse the lateral flow. So, these are really tricky issues, and as a deeply unintuitive, people struggle with them. And because in the summer, when there's very little virus around, it would be completely different. Then, the false positives become the problem because, it's so likely that people haven't got the virus.
We take it to the logical extreme. If you had a country with no coronavirus in it, and you did lateral flow tests on people, and say there's 1,000 people in that country, one of them's going to have coronavirus, even though they haven't, because the test picks up 1 in 1,000 as a false positive.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yes, yeah. I mean, that's sort of the situation, you know, when they were doing, Office for National Statistics were doing their surveys in the summer when there's, you know, 2020, there's very little virus around. And yet they were getting positives, but they were getting a few positives. And it's quite plausible that all of those were false positives. But it did put a sort of upper bound on what the false positive rate was for the PCRs. And so that was extremely useful because people were claiming that, oh, the PCR's got a massive false positive rate.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
The other thing which has been really, really hard from a statistical / epidemiological perspective has been gathering morbidity and mortality statistics. Because I remember Maggie de Blok, who was the Belgian health minister at the time, she very presciently said no one in the EU counts COVID the same. And the point she was trying to make is that all these data that are being presented and people are trying to make comparisons between countries, and effectively we ended up doing sort of apples with oranges comparisons because our numbers and our data were not the same as other countries. Has that been sorted out?
They're all still collecting it in odd ways. Now, you can understand why someone in Belgium would say that, because Belgium had was always...
they were top of the pile, weren't they?
Well, they're always top of the pile because they counted probable cases as COVID, even without confirmation.
We should have moved to Russia, where Vladimir Putin had a mysteriously low...
And Turkmenistan, where there's not been any cases so far, apparently. So it all depends on what... So the idea of comparing countries by how many reported COVID cases they've got has... It still happens. And it may be not too bad when you're comparing Western countries who've got broadly similar attitudes, but people have given that up as a way, basic way of comparing countries. And of course, I was thinking these are COVID deaths. That's where Belgium was always heading the league table, because they were very liberal about labelling something as a death with COVID. And other countries, of course, have no COVID deaths according to their registrations. And other countries, some countries don't even know how many deaths there've been in any case. So it's generally moved, if you're comparing countries, to compare mortality, to use excess deaths, just to look at you know, to coin a statistical phrase, to count the bodies, you know, regardless of what anyone has said they died of. And that eliminates all that arbitrariness. It still assumes a good death registration system, which isn't necessarily the case in some places. But then you get a very different view, and some countries come out very badly indeed, particularly increasingly looking like countries in Central and South America have had extremely high, ex-Peru and other Bolivia and others, extremely high death rates compared with normal. And whether they were called COVID or not is actually irrelevant. And in our country, in Britain, UK, we've either, if you look at COVID, even COVID death registrations, which are generally considered pretty gold standard, they were still an undercount in the first wave, because there was a big excess in non-COVID deaths in the first wave, particularly in care homes. And these were people, old people who died, and they almost certainly died of COVID, but they weren't seen by the GP to do the death certification because special rules came out. They didn't have to be seen by a doctor, and they weren't tested because nobody was being tested in that the early part of the first wave. And so even our death registrations have undercounted COVID deaths.
And hence, that's why Chris Whitty, at one of those early Downing Street press briefings, said, we have to wait for the end of the year and do an excess death analysis.
He said that very early on, and then Office for National Statistics then did it, and we spend quite a lot of time in the book talking about their findings, which were after the first wave, and then in this sort of ghastly league table, Britain was the worst in Europe, just about, and apart from some small places. And so we did really badly in the first wave. And, you know, we talk about that because if you go down through areas and even cities, you can see why. Because, you know, Madrid was really badly hit, around Milan, in North Italy, really badly hit. But in other countries, it was much more focused. There's some areas that got away quite lightly. Whereas in UK, okay, maybe the southwest got away quite lightly, but generally, it was all over the place. We were hit. The entire country was hit by an eruption of the epidemic. And we also know why. We cover this quite a lot in the book, that excellent paper which followed sort of genomic sequences and found, you know, more than 1,000 different genomic sequences for the virus, which were separate, you know, outbreaks. There were over 1,000 separate outbreaks in this country from people bringing it back, not from China, it was from France, Spain, and Italy in early March, mainly. And just bring it back from their holidays, and woof, off it went. So the epidemic erupted across the entire country pretty well, because we are a nation of enormous travellers. It's quite staggering how much we travel.
We've also got one of the world's busiest airports perched right on top of one of the world's busiest cities that moves more than the population of a small European country under its streets every day.
Oh yeah, so London did badly, but in fact, as I said, it was all over the country. They erupted all over the place. And so we got off to a terrible start, really very difficult to control. Again, in retrospect, people might say that we might have controlled our borders a bit better. But again, I'm not going to say that.
But to what extent, David, does that sort of take into account a sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul idea, in the sense that If we die now, I'm not here to die tomorrow. And it sounds macabre and a bit unpleasant to think in those terms. But statisticians and epidemiologists talk about this whole idea of harvesting, don't they? When something comes along and it wipes out a bunch of people, robbing them from the next threat, so they can't die then. So to what extent will there be a payback for other countries? We've paid already. We've paid up front. We've paid our dues. Other countries will catch us up.
Yeah, to some extent that might happen, except if other countries have now overtaken us with their vaccination programs, and so they are preventing that happening. And of course, Australia and New Zealand, they're not going to experience anything like what we experienced before the vaccine. This idea of harvesting does say is a pretty rough phrase. So I think mortality displacement is I think a better term to use, although I use harvesting as well. And it happens, of course, in cold winters, where the death rates will go up, and that's bringing forwards the vulnerable deaths that may have happened, over the next year anyway. And this is quite a contentious subject, and that it was claimed in the first wave that many of the people would have died, fairly soon anyway. Other people were saying, well, maybe half people would have died.
Boris Johnson got himself in trouble because he said, catch COVID, live longer, because he pointed to the fact the average age of a COVID victim at death was 82 and the average age of life expectancy in the UK was 80.
Yeah, well, this is complete nonsense, of course, but absolute bollocks. So, the point is that, roughly speaking, the average age of dying from COVID is the average age of dying from other things. And that's because, and this is an interesting statistical issue, what COVID does is take any risk that you've got at the moment and multiply it. It exaggerates any vulnerability you've got. We say in the book, the virus is a bully. It takes any weakness and exaggerates it. And what that means, if everyone's risk is raised roughly by the same amount, it means that the actual distribution of the ages at death doesn't change at all. But the whole thing goes up. There's more people dying. They're dying at the same ages as they did, but there's just more of them. And so this has been quite a difficult thing to explain. What it does mean, of course, is that, the risk, where you say in the book, the risk in the first wave for over 90s was 35,000 times the risks faced, not if you caught it, but just, from healthy over 90s, at 35,000 times the risk of dying from COVID than school kids. It was just amazing difference by age. Now, a number of those, a reasonable proportion, some of those older people would have died anyway over the next year. I was quoted last May, May 2020, I think slightly off the top of my head, as saying between 5 and 15%. I still think that's not a bad figure, because people have done models. Because we don't know if someone dies, how long they would have died, when they would have died anyway. In other words, that's sort of counterfactual. All we can do is estimate the years of life lost from victims of COVID. And when you look at the distribution, it's just like the R distribution for the number of people infected. It's hugely skewed, and that the most likely, the most common length of time lost is less than a year. Actually, that is the most common. So all these vulnerable people who died, there's a certain proportion who would have died in the next year. And that's the most common one. But then you've got a long tail that goes out to some people who have lost 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And the average comes out at about 10 years of life lost, even though the most common value is less than a year. So unless you draw the distribution, it's yet another example of where an average can be misleading. You want to see what the spread is and what that shape of that distribution is.
What about the other point that Chris Whitty, Chief Medical Officer, made very poignantly right at the beginning of all of this, when he said there will be direct deaths caused by coronavirus. There will be indirect deaths where people die because of, but not from, coronavirus. Have we got yet a kind of grip on how big that clinical iceberg is that we've created of people we haven't treated, people who haven't gone to the doctor, people who've got knock-on consequences, the hit to education and the disruption to the education of young people that will affect lifelong earnings, for example? Have we got some kind of idea yet what the lifelong health impact of that's going to be?
People have tried to estimate it. And again, in our book, we spend quite a long time talking about the collateral effects of lockdown. What Chris Whitty didn't mention, let's look on the bright side, is there will be lives saved because of the pandemic, because of the lockdown measures. There was no flu last year. So that it could be between 10 and 20,000 lives saved from that. Road accidents went down. We mentioned in the book that over 2020, the pandemic was a net lifesaver for young people. People between aged 15 and 29, 300 fewer died than we would have expected to die. And actually, more than 100 did die of COVID. So that means maybe 400 fewer deaths from other causes, and that would include road accidents and violence and other, you know, things that were prevented by young people essentially being locked up.
But if you've sown the seeds of mental illness and depression in those people by cooping them up, that's a lifelong legacy.
We're very careful to say that. It doesn't mean that lockdowns were a good thing, because we know, and because we've got measures of that, the increase in loneliness and depressive symptoms and so on. Now, but as you say, do we know what that is? Very difficult to measure. It's there. We haven't yet seen an impact, for example, on cancer deaths, but we wouldn't, I don't think, expect to start seeing that yet because of the delays in diagnosis and treatment. This is going to have a very long tail in terms of its impact. And people will be analysing this, you know, forever. It's going to be very difficult to separate out from all the other things that are going on in the future, including circulating COVID. So, we're going to have to make some inferences about that. People have been trying to estimate it. I think probably maybe the general feeling is that so far it might not look quite as bad as people worried about, but that we're in early days yet.
David, why did you write this?
Oh, well, I mean, it grew out of the fact that Andy Masters and I had been writing a column in The Observer. Amazing. A weekly stats column. We've done nearly 40 of these now. Started last January. And so we worked together well. And so we said, oh, let's try to write a book. And it's basically trying to explain about the numbers. It's not trying to judge everybody. It's not blaming or whatever. It's not advocating changes in policy or saying what was done was wrong, although we do point out some stuff. It's basically trying to do that, trying to help people through the morass of numbers we've been bombarded with. And of course, when we tried to write it, you realise, oh, God, there's so many, right? From, of course, the R, but, you know, right through to vaccine effectiveness, what does that mean, and so on. So we just try to explain all the stuff that everyone's been bombarded with over the last year and a half.
I wanted to talk to you to finish about the sort of end game, where this does end up. What would be your prediction then in terms of what's going to happen in the next few years?
I refuse to engage with such a...
But you don't, because you've devoted a page at the end of the book specifically to saying these are the scenarios, these could be the outcomes. So you do engage sometimes, David.
That's
You're very
true.
Cheeky
That's
to say
true.
That.
I shouldn't say that, I know. But I certainly won't make a prediction. No, there are all sorts of scenarios that can play out, depending on, you know, how optimistic or how pessimistic you are. And it depends what horizon you're talking about. You know, just over this winter, well, who knows? You know, it depends on the weather. It'll depend on the what sort of flu is circulating, what's going to happen. We kind of know. I think people are going to be confident there's not going to be a massive surge in COVID, you know, like we've seen in the previous waves. That's just not going to happen, not with the degree of immunity in the population. But the NHS could be really stretched. And I think that's the big issue. But it's, of course, it's always stretched every winter, but it could be even worse than normal. In terms of the longer term, I think, again, there's a certain amount it's not going to go away. I think people are fairly clear about that. Whether it'll settle down and be kind of like flu, in terms of both its severity, if you catch it, and how much is circulating, is another matter. Whether it's just going to add to winter woes, and so on, and how people will respond in terms of, you know, a lot of people are still very anxious not going out. Will they? There's nothing sudden going to happen. I don't think that will say, "Oh, we're free." You know, it's not Freedom Day. It did not mean Freedom Day. So I think we just don't know. I mean, then you think on an international scale, it's still not clear what's going to happen in Africa and other places with low vaccination rates. Hasn't hit them as badly as, for example, South America or India, but we don't know. And of course, we don't know, and again, come on, Mr. Virologist, are any nasty variants going to come along, or is it actually going to get weaker? So there's so many unknowns so many different ways it could turn out. But I think we can be confident, at least in this country, we're not going to see a return to massive increases, for example, in numbers of deaths. However, we could see enough new cases to threaten, just make the NHS close to not functioning, and we could see a reintroduction of some measures. They won't close schools. It would be back to working at home, because we know that is an effective way of reducing the number of contacts that people have. We do know that people who go to work have a lot more close contacts than people who don't. So that's an effective one. And, more stringent face mask wearing and, et cetera, more serious social distancing again come back. And it's quite plausible that will happen over the winter. And the government has actually blessed them. Have said, well, this is what we want to do, plan A, but we've got plan B up our sleeve, and said what plan B is. And I think that, again, is an enormous, enormous sort of, what I call sort of improvement in the trustworthiness of what the government's saying. The fact that they acknowledge that we don't know what's going to happen, and things may get bad, and then this is what we might do. So, because otherwise, I mean, this is what really I get fed up with the media about, is that they so love U-turn. They're pointing their fingers like kids in the playground. U-turn, U-turn. And all that's happened is that, they've changed their minds because things have changed. And by saying right in advance, well, things might change and then we'll do something different, if they'd only done that right the way through last year as well, had that maturity and confidence, instead of just saying, we're doing this, we know best, then they might have got away with being seen as a lot more trustworthy. Because when things did change, like Christmas closing down, all those sort of things, they could have said, yeah, well, we warned you this might happen. I mean, Chris Whitty, I think, has been excellent on this sort of stuff, but politicians just don't seem to be able to say, well, we're going to do this, but things might change, and then we might do something else. They just don't seem incapable of that sort of maturity.
One journalist, when watching one of those press conferences with Boris Johnson flanked by Chris Whitty and another commentator, said it was a case of a good cop, sad cop routine, because Chris Whitty looked extremely glum at the time. But you're not glum, David Spiegelhalter. Thank you very much for talking to us. David's book, written with Anthony Masters, is out now, and it's called COVID by Numbers. I'm Chris Smith. This is Intelligence Squared, and thanks very much for listening.